Proudly presented by Paul Everett's RV Country. This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, visiting today with 91-year-old Sarge Sargentini of Oakhurst, California. He served with the Bulge Busters of the 75th Infantry Division in World War II. When we left off, he had described a brutal artillery barrage on New Year's Eve, 1944, right in the middle of the Battle of the Bulge. And it's amazing what kind of specific memories and moments will stay with you for 70 years and flood back in your mind when something triggers it. And Sarge, you have something like that when it comes to that part of the Bulge.
Afterwards, back at the CP, somebody had a radio, and they were Bing Crosby was singing White Christmas. And that always got to me, you know, that funny how some things will remind you.
That's not the kind of White Christmas you had in mind. You're out there in the snow in the coldest winter Europe had ever seen, but he says, I'm dreaming of a white Christmas. You were probably dreaming of coming back home, huh?
Well, I wasn't dreaming of a white Christmas, that's for sure. I knew it wasn't. I was wishing I was home, yes.
And every year, I'm sure you hear that song once or twice during the holiday season. What comes to mind for you when you hear that come on the radio?
I turn it off or I walk away.
It's just too painful for you to remember what you saw?
Well, it brings back a lot of memories, and sometimes, you know, something will... It's just like when I went by the Vietnam Wall, this honor flight. It just does something to you. It just brings... When you see a lot of dead people and you picture them in your mind, you know, you see them, and then to know there was 400,000 guys... I didn't see that many, but I can see people laying all over the snow and like that. I see them get loaded up in trucks after it's all over with, and they're just like cordwood. They throw them in the back into the trucks and frozen bodies. So it never leaves you. You think back. You something reminds you of it.
Well, as you share that, I'm thinking of what's inscribed at the National World War II Memorial, where all those gold stars are, representing 406,000 Americans who died in World War II. It says, here we mark the price of freedom. And when you think the price of freedom, do you think of what you saw at the Battle of the Bulge?
Yes. I don't spend much time thinking about it or anything like that. You know, you start thinking about it, then you start dreaming about it, and it gets to you. So I guess I'm cold-hearted, maybe you might say, because I wipe it out.
Well, that's self-preservation, because a lot of guys still have those flashbacks 70 years later, and I hear what you're saying with that. That said, most people alive today, maybe they've heard of the Battle of the Bulge, but they don't know what it was really like, and I realize it was different. There are a ton of American servicemen involved in this, and every experience was different, but you hear everyone talk about the cold. How cold was it, and what kind of conditions did you have to deal with? What kind of accommodations did you have?
Well, we didn't have the best of accommodations, but we had it better than the front line boys. They had to sleep in their foxholes, and at least we got to go back to the regiment where we had billets sometimes, and sometimes we didn't, but at least we weren't sleeping in mud and water and like that. Now, those boys really went through hell. I remember freezing my little feet off, but not like they did, you know. At least I wore big, heavy boots, and those rubber boots, and used to wrap my feet up with torn-up army blankets.
With that experience at the Battle of the Bulge and the one you shared where the mine goes off, 8 guys very close to you are killed. You're knocked against the wall, so you're injured. You even said you broke your pelvis but didn't get medical attention at the time. You had shared when you went overseas, you didn't give a thought to, I might not come home. After that happened and you were that close to it, did it change your perspective moving forward?
Yes, I was kind of worried every time. And every time we heard a buzz bomb, one of those robot planes.
So for people who don't know, the buzz bomb, like you said, robot's a good word for it. It's unmanned, but it's flying and it's ticking away and you don't know when it's going to fall from the sky, right?
Exactly. As long as you could hear it coming, you worried about it. But as soon as it got over you, then you could quit worrying because you knew that once it started down, it was going to be away from you. I had one narrow escape in Liège where we saw it coming. We heard it first and then we saw it. and it flew right over us and went across from us maybe a quarter mile or so, but it blew up a lot, and we were on convoy at the time, so we never knew just what the effects of it were. When we first got into combat, they put me on guard, saw my first buzz bomb then. At first I thought it was tracer, because we had an air raid that night and the tracers were just flying all over, and I saw this big red blob going, and I thought it was a tracer, but it didn't go out, and it was a buzz bomb, and it came down about maybe probably a half a mile from me, but I heard the explosion, and luckily nothing around me.
I've heard a lot of different perspectives from a lot of different guys, but I'm just listening to your story, from the mine to the buzz bomb to I'm sure what were ever-present 88 shells heading your guys' way as well. It almost seems like you're helpless, like you're not in control. You don't know when your number's going to get called. How did you deal with that? Did you believe that someone was protecting you? Did you say, hey, I hope I'm lucky today? How did you think of all that?
I never gave that a thought. I thought I was just lucky. At that time, I wasn't religious or anything like that. So, but there's a lot of praying whenever you're in close quarters like that. You know, you think, if I ever get out of this, I'm going to go to church, you know, and this and that, I'm going to believe and all that. So there's a lot of atheists that probably turned religious.
So that's not a myth. You actually found yourself in some situations where, even though that wasn't a regular habit for you, you found yourself praying.
Exactly, yes. I did that countless times. And there were some funny incidents too, you know, when my buddy and I had been looking over a canal. At the time, we were in a broken up house that had been bombed, and we were looking across the canal to see if we could see. There was activity on the other side. There were Germans, and we could see over there and see movement and see cars and what have you. And all of a sudden, a shell hit the house that we were on. We started getting out of there, but as we were going up, it had ripped up the floor, and the Germans, the people that occupied the house at the time, had buried all their money, had stored all their money between the subfloor, I guess they'd called it, and the regular floor. And there was millions of dollars right there, because German money just flew out of there in bundles. And that money out there, they counted in 500,000 marks and 100,000 marks and 200,000, and like that, you know, big numbers. So we grabbed all the big numbers that we could, because we thought, man, we're rich, you know. I still probably have some of them left right there, but we found out that they weren't worth anything because the German government was kaput.
Yeah, that's what happens. But it sure was fun while it lasted in those moments, huh?
Yes, it was. It was funny.
I'm sure there are some other lighthearted moments like that. What can you tell us about the relationships you built with the guys you served with, and how you felt about them, and how much trust or dependability you guys had to have in each other?
Well, we did. I had two very good friends. One we called Snake. His name was W.H. Moore. And the other one was McIntosh, Clifford McIntosh. And we were very close. We built a lot of close friendships while we were there, our bunk mates and like that. But none is real close, you know, buddies. It was just like knowing the people that you went to school with. You probably only had one or two real close friends. The rest of them were friends.
Did you notice a difference after the bulge? Did things change as far as what you encountered, even what kind of work you had to do?
Yes, we were kind of sent, I don't know if it was to clean up and like that, but we went to a resort town, it seemed like, a place called Plattenberg. And that was just like going up to Yosemite or up to Wawona, you know. It was a beautiful area like that, and it hadn't been touched by the war. We took some of the best billets around there, and then all we did was police the area. We would go out looking for Germans returning themselves in all over, and we just went all over the country looking. As far as work, we never did any work or anything. We just enjoyed the vacation that we were on until we got the news that Roosevelt was dead, and everybody was sad about that, I remember. And after that, we came home. Well, we didn't all come home. We came home by the numbers, those people that had higher numbers than we had would come home first, and those with the lesser numbers. I only had 55 points at the time, so I was kind of in the middle.
I may be wrong on this, but just listening to your story and trying to read between the lines and put two and two together here, you're talking about your points. One thing that would have given you more points is if you had the Purple Heart. And it sure sounds like that incident with the mine would have made you eligible for the Purple Heart.
Well, to me, a wound is something that you have to get taken care of, to be hospitalized with, you know, that you, very serious. Mine weren't that serious. I could walk. It wasn't until way later that I went to, when we got sent back to France for coming home. Then I went to the doctor. But before that, I had shrapnel. It got me in the arm right there. I'd had my arm wrapped around a cement pole. A bullet hit the pole right there and split and took my arm all the across here. And I had pieces up in my arm there, right there for years until they just disappeared.
So besides breaking your pelvis, you had the length of your arm wounded, and you actually had pieces of shrapnel still in your arm, but you never wanted the Purple Heart.
No, well, I never thought of it. You know, at that time, it was not a laughing matter. No, a Purple Heart is not a laughing matter. But it seems like some guys that were in the hospital with VD, they were getting Purple Hearts. So it says anybody can get a Purple Heart, you know. And I didn't know that it was going to be worth anything, or I would try my best to get him, you know. So I got that, I got my butt, and I got a piece of shrapnel went through my helmet right there.
Where was that, the shrapnel through your helmet?
In Burtonville, we were caught behind the lines, so we were shelled with mortars from the Germans and from our own artillery. They thought we were Germans, and they knew we were Americans. So anyway, we got the heck out of there. Again, we were following some engineers. One of my guys, he got caught in the butt with shrapnel too. It hit about 10 feet from us, and you can't dig in the snow. I mean, you can dig in the snow, but you can't get past that layer of ice underneath it. Yeah. So we were down as far as we could go.
And this was friendly fire?
We don't know, because it was coming from both sides, but we got out of there. The lieutenant was trying to get out to tell them to stop, you know. Whether they heard, I don't know. Our telephone wasn't doing any good because we hadn't connected anything. We were still following, so it wasn't a funny situation. But when, like, my guy was down and we tried to tear his pants off to get to the wound, and he said, no, he says, I'll pull him down. He says, I don't want to freeze to death. This is because we were going to cut his pants off. Anyway, he got all right. I think he got the Purple Heart because he never saw him again. He went to France to get taken care of. So, and they gave me an option with my hind end. When I was blown up with that thing, I went on sick call when I got back to the rest area. And he says, well, we can do one thing. He says, we can let nature take its course, or we can send you back to some hospital there. He says, and they can cut it out. But I had heard that those guys that went back like that, they wound up in different outfits when they got well, so I didn't want to do that. I wanted to stay with my outfit. So I said, let's let nature take its course. I didn't get any medication or nothing.
Just dealt with daily pain, probably.
For a while. It disappeared, but on long rides or anything like that, you have to shift from one cheek to the other. But I don't think it's that. I think it's just old age with me.
So when was it that you did come home?
May of 1946.
So you were over there quite a while after Germany surrendered. Do you remember VE Day? Do you remember where you were and whether that was a big deal?
I was in Plattenburg, Germany at the time, at VE Day. And after that, it was, like I said, transferred from one unit to another, so accumulating enough points to come home, and wound up going to Oberammergau in Bavaria. So I spent time up there in the snow, in the high Alps, beautiful country. And we were billeted in what used to be airplane parts manufactured, you know. There were tunnels in there where they used to have their factories and like that. But anyway, we had regular billets where the Germans had lived before.
Speaking of the Germans, what kind of interactions did you have with them, with German civilians or even German soldiers before or after the surrender?
German soldiers, we never talked too much. With the civilians, yes. I got friendly with German families over there while we were there, maybe a couple of gals. There was a little girl crying one time out in Wiesbaden, Germany. And this little girl was really hysterical, crying. So I says, what's the matter? What's the matter? You know, this and that. And I think she was lost, you know. Anyway, somebody came over and she said, that's Anna Meyer was her name, the woman that, she says she's staying with her grandmother, Anna Meyer. So they looked up Anna Meyer and met Anna Meyer. So I got friendly with her through her, friends with her for a long time, all the time that we were there, because she used to make good cookies and stuff. So, and I would give her coffee and stuff like that. You know, she was old. She was an old woman. And so there was no romance or anything like that, you know, involved. But anyway, just through that little girl right there, Etika was her name.
I love it when we hear stories like that. Reminders that even in the midst of a horrific worldwide war, those moments of human compassion and connection are always there. We're not done yet with 91-year-old Sarge Sargentini. The rest of his story when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Remember when the bank gave you free checking and savings accounts, even making money for you when you kept your dollars there? Paul Effler here to say I've recaptured those days, and you can too with EECU. It's not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that just keeps growing and growing. The newest branch is in Tulare, and nearly a 250,000 EECU members represent 10 different California counties. As little as $250 in a savings account earns you dividends. And access is so easy. 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And I haven't even told you what I love most about EECU, the credit union's support of causes up and down our area, like Central Valley Honor Flight. Close to 500 World War II veterans have gotten to see their memorial in Washington, D.C. for free because of the leadership and financial support of EECU. Ready to join the team yet? Call 1-800-538-3328.